You're listening to The Globalist, first broadcast on the 27th of April 2022 on Monocle 24. The Globalist, in association with UBS. This is The Globalist, broadcasting to you live from Midori House in London. I'm Georgina Godwin. On the show ahead...
I came to Moscow as a messenger of peace. My objective and my agenda is strictly linked to save lives and to reduce suffering.
We'll get a readout from the UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres' meeting at the Kremlin yesterday, assess the latest from within Ukraine, and we'll hear from Moldova as the country fears being pulled into the war. As Australia ramps up towards the May election, we'll be in Canberra to examine the fallout from the security pact between China and the Solomon Islands. Then to Sudan, where 6 months after the coup, the country remains steeped in violence and on the brink of a severe humanitarian crisis. We'll get the latest business headlines, have a flick through the papers, and...
There is a little bit of an image problem with some of their programming. And let's remember, a lot of people moved to Netflix at the beginning because it was kind of prestige television. They have series like House of Cards. They have that still, but less.
We'll ask if our viewing habits are about to change fundamentally. That's all ahead here on The Globalist, live from London. Now, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres was in Russia yesterday, where he met with both Vladimir Putin and his foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. This came after Lavrov gave a wide-ranging interview to state television in which he warned that the conflict in Ukraine risks escalating into a third world war and that the risk of a nuclear conflict must not be underestimated. Guterres is visiting Ukraine today. Mark Galliotti is a Russia expert and the author of The Weaponization of Everything, A Field Guide to the New Way of War. And Irina Matveyushin is a freelance journalist currently in Lviv. Welcome to both of you. Thanks so much for joining us. Mark, this is a very serious statement from Lavrov. He appears to justify it by saying that NATO was, in essence, engaged in a proxy war with Moscow by supplying Kyiv with weapons. Can you unpick his remarks for us?
Yes, I think there's really two things that we need to focus in on. One is this whole talk about World War III and nuclear war. It's a fairly classic Russian tactic that, given that there's no real question that NATO would actually initiate a nuclear exchange in these circumstances, they're just basically trying to, you know, conjure this terrifying spectre really as a way of trying to intimidate us, to try and to get us to back off. It's a little bit more extreme at the moment. It's a little bit more advanced. But nonetheless, this is a tactic we have seen, frankly, for years. So, you know, although obviously we can never take any sort of reference to nuclear war lightheartedly, nonetheless, I think that's the context. However, what I think is much more important is the way that the Russians are now really stressing this point that this is a conflict not really with Ukraine, but with NATO, with Ukraine as the proxy and the battleground. Firstly, because that really tells us, I think, a lot about how the Russians genuinely do see this. But secondly, because this then potentially, and I think I want to stress that potentially, could be the excuse to actually escalate from this so-called special military operation into calling this a full-scale war, at which point it unlocks all kind of additional options for the Russians in terms of mobilizing their reserves, sending conscripts in without needing them to volunteer and that kind of thing. So I think that's the thing that we really need to be watching quite carefully. Has sharpening Russian rhetoric mean an escalation could be on the way?
And what's your reading of Guterres's Kremlin meetings with both Lavrov and Putin?
I mean, look, I wasn't really expecting very much, and I think it has delivered. I mean, Guterres isn't really in a position to do more than try and sort of bring, frankly, moral authority to bear. And we know that this Kremlin is not really that interested in moral authority. The Russians were willing to go along in broad terms about, yes, we should cooperate to try and find humanitarian sort of, you know, evacuation routes for the citizens of Mariupol and so forth. But I don't really think it has in any way changed the Kremlin's calculus.
And Irina, let's bring you in here. How have the Kremlin talks been received in Ukraine?
Ukrainians are pretty much skeptical about all the talks with the Kremlin. They keep reiterating every now and then, especially now with the UN, because mostly Ukrainians are skeptical of the UN, UN's work in Ukraine, and also about the possibility of evacuation from Mariupol, since we've already heard and saw in Russian that Russian Defense Ministry stated that they deported around 1 million Ukrainians to Russia, and there's indeed evidence that they did deport a lot of people from there. And from the experience of Ukrainians, we don't see how these talks can lead to real green corridors for both civilians and defenders. And the General Secretary of the UN was talking about the evacuation of only of civilians, but there are dozens of Ukrainian defenders who are injured and who are in need to be evacuated. Otherwise, they will be captured and tortured and killed. The other issue about the evacuation of civilians is that they might be taken to Russia illegally. And as we've seen with the cooperation of the Red Cross with the Russian government, says that the possibility of evacuating them to Russia, not to the Ukrainian territory, is quite high. So there are a lot of issues that make Ukrainians even more suspicious about these talks and the outcome of these talks.
And just looking at the military side, Mark, we know that up to 40 countries have been meeting in a German airbase talking about a military response. Germany's promised to send 50 tanks to Ukraine. How significant is that?
It is significant. I mean, it's significant on two levels. I mean, these are essentially anti-aircraft tanks called the Gepard, which is important because they actually provide a certain degree of additional short-range air defense capability. More to the point, though, it's not actually so much about the hardware itself. It's about this. This breaks another one of Germany's self-imposed taboos. It has, you know, been very clearly the case that the Germans have been dragging their feet amongst the various NATO allies in terms of their willingness to provide direct assistance to the Ukrainians, military assistance. And I think this is therefore quite a sort of a powerful way forward. They start with anti-aircraft vehicles, but the point is that could conceivably open the way up to a whole variety of other weapons in the future. So this is a move forward. I mean, it's rather belated. A lot of other countries have been much, much more active in supporting the Ukrainians, but it's a definite move nonetheless.
And Irina, do you feel that Ukraine's getting enough support from its international partners?
Well, I definitely see it on the news, but I also talked to military men on the ground. And recently I went to Mykolaiv and I met soldiers in a cafe, and they were like telling me to tell to the world that they need more heavy weapons because they have nothing to fight with. Maybe this weapons is still on its way, but we do hear from the military men that they are in need of more supplies.
And Mark, what can you tell us about attacks on Russian villages? I mean, there are conflicting reports. These might have been carried out by Ukrainians or by Russia itself in an attempt to justify the war.
Well, I mean, this idea of them being false flag operations now, you know, if one looks at the recent attacks in the pro-Russian separatist area of Moldova, Transnistria, that seems more plausible that it's all part of a political justification. But more broadly, I mean, I think the way that the Russian propaganda machine has been sort of pumping out a phenomenally toxic narrative about Ukraine, I don't really think that the Kremlin needs that. So I think it is more likely that if this is the result of some kind of hostile action, and we've got to remember that accidents and fires and things happen all the time in Russia. We're just kind of focusing on them rather more. You know, it demonstrates that this war is necessarily expanding. That up to now, you might say the Russians have always tended to be the ones who actually get to break the rules with a degree of impunity. Well, you know, the Ukrainians clearly are not willing to sit back and let Moscow determine the scope of the operation. And so they are beginning to use, whether it's long-range missiles or whether it's special forces groups, but one way or the other, or drones indeed, they are beginning to actually operate in Russian territory as well. And again, I think this is meant to be both a way of bringing further pressure to bear on the Kremlin, but also as a way of bringing the realities of the war closer to ordinary Russian people. It's a kind of another way of trying to punch through the information shroud that the Kremlin has thrown over this special military operation.
Mm. Irina, I wonder how widespread the claims of war crimes by Russian soldiers are. I mean, we've heard of the terrible events in Bucha, but it's not just there, is it?
Yes, it's not only Bucha, and the investigations are ongoing in the whole Kyiv region around the city of Kyiv, and they still find these graves like that people were buried in all kinds of places, in yards and in fields. And it's all like an ongoing process, and many more deaths are found in the region, even though the interest of the international media is fading. And we will learn more about these atrocities and mass graves in Mariupol when we have access to the city. But right now, due to the satellite images, we can already see how many mass graves are found around Mariupol, even without having access to that place. So yes, it's happening all over places where Russians took control of in Kherson region as well.
Mm. And Mark, were war crimes addressed by the Secretary General?
Yes, but again, not in the kind of, you know, direct and full-throated way that many would have liked. I mean, the Secretary General always has to, frankly, tiptoe around these kind of very tense issues. Plus, we have to realize that it's not just what the Secretary General says, but there are also a certain amount of, you know, official-to-official conversations in the sidelines. But in practice, it was not really a central feature of this. I mean, Gutierrez himself presented his visit as being about humanitarian aid for civilians caught in the war zone rather than anything else. He knows full well that if he had actually gone in heavily on the war crimes issue, the Russians, frankly, would have just simply closed ranks the way they always do.
Mm. Irina, on humanitarian aid, we know that the UN Refugee Agency has increased its estimate of the number of people that it expects to leave Ukraine this year to 8.3 million. Now, 5 million have already fled, 7.7 million are internally displaced. I mean, what more can the international community do? What do you expect from the UN Refugee Agency? How can they help?
Well, right now, a lot of civilians that left to the other Ukrainian territories to safe places, they are in need of help as well. It's not only refugees who leave the country, it's also IDPs who are just displaced to other regions. And many of them, actually, they don't have anything, any belongings, any like basic needs. Also, people in the places that were totally destroyed, like in the area around Chernihiv, their houses were turned into rubble, and volunteers provide some of the most basic needs to them, like hygienic kits. And these volunteers told us that they get money from mostly from private initiatives, not from big organizations. So I think it's worth for these big organizations to ask what small Ukrainian NGOs and volunteer organizations need to provide direct help to civilians affected by war. Regarding the refugees, I think the UN is doing a pretty good job outside Ukraine. But as I said, another issue is their work on the ground.
Mm. And just quickly before we go, Mark, we understand that Russia will stop supplying gas to Poland and Bulgaria today because they refuse to pay for it in rubles. What impact is that going to have? Could this be decisive in the war, cutting off energy supplies?
No, I mean, particularly if a country like Poland is currently in a situation where frankly, it would rather basically go cold than actually give any further ground to the Russians. I mean, this is clearly a very, very sort of powerful issue in Poland. And generally, I mean, let's be honest, this is the wrong season. We're beginning to come out of the winter season. Countries are more able to cope with this. You know, if this had been November, then maybe that would have been a different issue. But what it does do is demonstrate the degree to which actually Moscow is trying to sort of see how far it can really play hardball. You know, it needs or rather it would like the income it gets from selling oil and gas to Europe. It also knows that Europe is committed to actually phasing Russian oil and gas out. So it's trying to see what kind of political capital it can gain before that happens.
Mark Galeotti and also Irina Matveyishin there. Thank you both very much indeed. It's 16:15 in Canberra, 7:15 here in London. Now, as we reported last week, the Solomon Islands have signed a security pact with China, details of which are still unclear. The United States has said that it doesn't rule out military action if China establishes a military base in the Pacific Island nation, with the Australian Prime Minister backing that up by remarking that it would be a red line for Australia and its allies. Scott Morrison, who's facing re-election on May the 21st, is struggling to close the gap with the main opposition amid criticism over his handling of the security pact. Well, Karen Middleton is the Saturday paper's chief political correspondent in Canberra and joins me now. Karen, can you recap what this Solomon Island-China deal is and why it's important to Australia?
Well, we don't know an awful lot about it yet, Georgina. That's part of the problem. It's been quite secretive. We've sort of seen a draft of it, but it's a military agreement, and there is some an agreement for military cooperation, and there is some debate over whether or not that will involve a military base in the Solomons, as you mentioned. It's of importance to Australia because the Pacific is positioned between Australia and the United States, and because it provides access to the region for a major power, and that could be risky in the event that that major power suddenly decides that it has less than positive things on its mind about engaging with countries around the region. So Australia is nervous about having a greater Chinese military presence around the region. It's been working to try and avoid this happening, but it seems somehow we've dropped the ball and in terms of influence, and the Solomons has opted to negotiate this treaty with the Chinese.
Mm. And Washington, what have they said? I mean, the strong words.
They're disappointed and unhappy. Be interesting to know what's being said behind the scenes, that there was a high-level delegation on its way to the Solomons to try and dissuade the Solomon Islands government from finally signing off on this when, in fact, the final signing off was announced. So they were too late, effectively, but they have been there to try and talk to the Solomon Islands about what it might mean and whether there's an alternative path. Australia has been involved in trying to engage in the Pacific. It undertook what the Prime Minister has called a Pacific step up 4 years ago to try and boost aid and engagement, cultural exchange, Pacific workers coming to Australia to earn money and send money back home. But one of the areas where Australia has not done what many of the Pacific Islands have wanted is in the area of action on climate change. They've demanded for many years that there be a stronger stance in terms of action on climate change because it's an existential crisis for many of those Pacific Islands. And that's an area where perhaps Australia, successive governments in Australia, have been lacking.
Mm. I just wonder whose interests a Chinese military base on the Solomon Islands would serve. I mean, surely China would prefer trade. And presently we see it limiting its military ambitions to places that they view as part of China. We know that they already have a deal with Fiji to no particular ill effect. China has its own, Australia has its own deal with the Solomon Islands. Is the reaction a little hysterical?
I think there's a lot of concern about what China's intentions are. China plays a very long game. I think they have something like a 500-year plan for China, and then they don't have to be bothered by anything pesky like democracy. So their governments don't change. They stay in place. And there is concern both in the region and I think in the United States about what China might be planning in terms of its future military engagement. It's certainly been active in the South China Sea, and there is very much concern in this part of the Indo-Pacific region that China might be trying to exert greater and greater military influence. So it's seen as planning ahead on China's part. It's used the Pacific Islands' need for aid and monetary assistance as leverage, and where other countries have left a vacuum or a gap, it has stepped in and offered money. There's been a criticism that it has created some indebtedness among those countries. So what might look benign at this point, many experts say, is ultimately likely not to be benign. And for China to have a foothold in some of these countries could be useful if it ends up in a conflict with the United States.
Now, Australia's strength in the Pacific region is surely soft power. And I wonder how damaging Morrison's, quite frankly, bullying rhetoric about red lines is and the talk of Australia's backyard.
Well, it's interesting that the Prime Minister always talks about this being the Pacific family, and he talks up Australia's relations with these countries in the Pacific. But you're right, he has upped his rhetoric in the context of our election campaign once this deal with the Solomons was announced between the Solomons and China, and he has talked about a red line. And that begs the question, well, if the red line is crossed and there is a military base set up in the Solomons, what are we going to do? What is that threat, actually? And he hasn't been able to articulate that or hasn't been willing to. So I think, you know, you get into a risky position where you're making a threat and drawing a line, but then not saying what happens if it gets crossed. Mm. And that's now the territory that we're in.
And just finally, I mean, how is this Solomon Islands deal playing into the Australian election? It's under a month away. We're seeing the poll widen. What do you think is going to happen?
In terms of domestic politics, it's very bad timing for the Morrison government because it has been running hard on national security and suggesting that the Labor opposition is going to be weaker on national security, particularly in relation to China, and that the Morrison government needs to be re-elected because it's stronger and will stand up to China and avoid having China get extra influence. So for China to suddenly have extra influence in the region has given rise to criticisms that the Morrison government has dropped the ball, and it makes those arguments much harder to make.
Karen, thank you very much indeed. That's Karen Middleton in Canberra there. Still to come in the programme, we take a look at the violence in Sudan. We'll cross to Honiara to hear how Moldova fears being drawn into the Russian-Ukraine conflict. And
there is a little bit of an image problem with some of their programming. And let's remember, a lot of people moved to Netflix at the beginning because it was kind of prestige television. You have series like House of Cards. They have that still, but less.
We'll find out why the taps might be turned off for the streaming giants. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
Last year, Sudanese generals overthrew a civilian-led government in the country, and since then, Sudan's Darfur region has seen bouts of deadly clashes between rival tribes as the country remains embroiled in a wider crisis following the coup in October. Now, there are reports that at least 168 people have been killed in recent days, with dozens more wounded. Sharath Srinivasan is the co-director of the University of Cambridge's Centre of Governments and Human Rights and the author of When Peace Kills Politics, International Intervention and Unending Wars in the Sudans. Sharath, thanks very much for joining us. Can you tell us how the situation's developed since the coup on October the 25th last year?
Well, thanks, Georgina. So indeed, it's been a really restive period in Sudan since that coup in October. That's both in the city, in the capital, with protests against the coup, which we can talk about in a while, but also importantly, in parts of the country that have seen war for many decades. So the most recent events that you're talking about are in West Darfur, so right on the border in the west with Chad. And this really is a throwback to the early 2000s when some of the worst violence in Darfur was occurring in this region. And what we've seen in the period since the coup, and indeed in the period leading up to the coup, is increasingly insecurity, clashes between rival militias and rival groups that have also then spiraled into bringing in the state, the army as well. Most recently, these clashes occurred and led to a rampaging, in effect, of a rural town and then the capital of the province, El Geneina, including the hospital being shut down, and then the bringing in of militia of the government from Khartoum to quell the violence. Mm. So it's a it's conflagrating much more than it has in the past.
And I wonder what the violence tells us about the current security situation in Sudan. I mean, 6 months on from the coup, how stable is the current political situation?
It's very, very unstable. So what really, the centre of what enabled the coup to happen was an agreement between previously former rebel movements who had sided with the army and the leadership around the security elements in the former government of al-Bashir, and they'd sided on the coup side of things against the civilian movements that had been pursuing the democratic transition. Now, that uneasy bedfellows of the militia leaders and the former leaders of the security establishment is starting to fray. And we're seeing this in places like Darfur, where former leaders of rebel movements who are now provincial governors or in senior positions in the government are condemning the violence that's in effect being enacted by some of the groups that are government sponsored and government backed. So the coup itself led to protests on the streets in places like Khartoum by the civilian opposition who wanted to see the democratic transition. But it's also seeing internal rivalries come to the fore as well. All of this with the backdrop of the fact that there's no longer a peacekeeping force in Darfur, the UNAMID peacekeeping force, the UN and African Union sponsored peacekeeping force stopped its work in late 2020. So there's a sort of security vacuum that's occurring in some of these areas, like in Darfur. Meanwhile, these protests against the coup that continue in places like the capital and increasingly cracked down in hard ways.
How strong is the pro-democracy movement?
It's proven to be very, very resilient. Now, how strong it is in terms of being able to change the course of direction in the country is yet to be seen. But since the coup in October, the resistance on the street, these neighborhood resistance committees that banded together and repeatedly come out into the street, has shown tremendous amount of courage as well as strength. However, what we've seen increasingly is that as the democratic transition as such has proven to be dead, and the those in charge of the country now, those who led the coup, are increasingly less concerned about appeasing international actors who want to support the transition, they've come out much more harshly against the protesters, and the level of violence against protesters has increased. So we're seeing a reversion really to an authoritarian security state. I think the any talk of the democratic transition is dead. But I guess on the street, you also have a sense that those who are pursuing the civilian revolution are not giving up.
And what are the prospects then for an election?
I think the prospects for election are very slim indeed, or at least an election that we would consider free or fair, or one that is adequate to involve a plural set of political voices. Right now, they're very slim indeed. I think the idea of a transition to elections is both resisted by those in charge of the country, those who enacted the coup. It's also resisted by those on the street who feel like this sort of modest transition is insufficient and it just reinforces the security military establishment's control over power. So for all groups, except for perhaps some of the international actors who would like to resuscitate the transition to a democratic election, this is no longer the game in town. Something more fundamental has to happen, both for civilian forces, groups to feel like there was actually real change in the country. So we get this sense that the transition is dead, but the revolution sort of as such lives on, and democratic elections will have to come out of that process, but can't be mapped as it had been before.
And finally, Sharath, what about the humanitarian situation?
It's very, very dire. So the other thing, there are a few things that have been going on in Sudan over the last couple of years, which indeed led to al-Bashir's fall and led to these changes. One of them is just a really deteriorating humanitarian situation, spiraling inflation, really an economy that's in absolute crisis. Now with the threats to, global commodities because of the Ukrainian war, this will put increasing pressure on some of the basic staples in Sudan. So that has led to levels of malnutrition and potential famine and starvation that we haven't seen for many decades. So that is, you know, a real concern, and it's proving to be harder and harder to get the adequate humanitarian support into parts of rural Sudan that really need it. The other thing to note is that actually these levels of hardship and hunger are being seen in urban centres in ways that were not really seen in the past. The urban centres were always relatively protected from this kind of crisis, but we're seeing those levels of hunger and hardship in the urban centres as well.
Shira, thank you very much indeed. Here's what else we're keeping an eye on today. Russia has halted gas supplies to Poland. Under the Yamal contract, the Central European nation will stop receiving natural gas from Russia's Gazprom via Belarus and Ukraine. Bulgaria, like Poland, a NATO and EU member, said earlier that Russia would also halt supplies of gas there. Ukraine has accused Russia of blackmailing Europe over energy in an attempt to break its allies. A court in military-ruled Myanmar has sentenced deposed leader Aung San Suu Kyi to 5 years in jail after finding her guilty in the first of 11 corruption cases. The Nobel laureate, who led Myanmar for 5 years before being forced from power in early 2021, has been charged with at least 18 offences, which carry combined maximum jail terms of nearly 190 years if found guilty. And Tesla has lost $126 billion in value amid investor concerns that chief executive Elon Musk may have to sell shares to fund his $44 billion buyout of Twitter. The EU and the UK have also warned Musk against skirting new rules, stating that Twitter must still comply with new content rules or face sanctions that range from fines to a total ban. This is The Globalist. Stay tuned. Yesterday, there were several more explosions reported in the Moldovan breakaway region of Transnistria following an attack on the building of the Transnistria Ministry of State Security on Monday. Russia has had troops permanently based in the region since the collapse of the Soviet Union in the early 1990s. Well, Alina Radu is a journalist and manager of The Guard newspaper, the largest investigative media organisation in Moldova, and she joins me on the line now. Alina, I wonder if you could give us a quick recap on the status of the Transnistria region.
Hello, nice to meet you. Transnistria region is a part of Republic of Moldova that was created 30 years ago, but the same time when Soviet Union collapsed, Russian army stayed there, stationed there, and never left. And we had a war in 1992. And after that, this region named themselves a separate country. We just have to say that during 30 years, no one country in the world recognized Transnistria as a separate state, nor Russia. So it remains forever a part of Moldova. By law, but it was always under Russian control. The Russian army was there despite the fact that Russia promised in front of OSCE or other global and European international organizations to withdraw the army. They never did this. So at this moment, everything there is controlled by Russia. There is a Russian army, there are Russian troops. And Moldova doesn't have any instruments to control the situation there.
And what is the detail on these blasts?
That's why it is hard to know the truth. It's hard to have other sources of information. We can have information like only from Transnistrian region authorities. So at this moment, there were blasts, but thanks to all circumstances, nobody died, no victims. It was a free day because it was Easter in Moldova, and on Monday, it was the second day of Easter, and it was a free day, so people were not in offices. And the other blasts didn't make any victims, so Transnistrian authorities say that it was a Ukrainian military who did so, but no proofs released in public space, so we can't say. And Moldovan President Maia Sandu said that these blasts might be the result of some internal conflicts in the Transnistrian region.
I mean, how likely is it that the country could be used as a launch pad for Russian troops to attack Ukraine? And is the population of Moldova worried about being drawn into the war?
Of course we are worried, because we have this Russian army in our territory for 30 years. And for 30 years, we were said that if you don't behave well, if we don't like you, if I don't know what we do, they have this big army, big depot, and big everything, and like, you know, big power. It is a very difficult situation psychologically now, because Moldova had received and has now on its territory 100 of thousands of Ukrainian refugees, and these are the most vulnerable people, like women with children and elderly people. So should we leave? Should everybody leave? Should we leave out only elderly here and kids? It is a really difficult situation, because we had our problems, our poverty, and now we have more problems. And then these threats. And if I look, and I have to follow media in Transnistrian region professionally, and I follow a lot of Telegram channels, and Telegram channels from Transnistrian region say, okay, wait, we'll come for you in Moldova, and you'll see when you'll have blasts there. And the border is like not controlled, like everybody from Transnistrian region may come every day to Chisinau or to any place in Moldova, and it is not the rule of law now to control everybody if he has any weapon or not. So yes, the situation is difficult, but the only reasonable decision is to stay and work and to make Moldova better till the moment it won't be possible.
Alina, thank you very much indeed. That's Alina Radu there talking to us from Moldova. It is 7:36 in London, 8:36 in Zurich, and we'll continue now with today's newspapers. Joining me is Phil Clark, live in the studio, Professor of International Politics at SOAS at the University of London. Good morning to you, Phil.
Good morning, Georgina.
Phil, we've been reporting in our headlines that Aung San Suu Kyi has been sentenced to 5 years for corruption. Of course, we know that this is just the beginning. She's up for a number of other charges. It adds up to something like 196 years in jail if she's convicted. What does The Guardian have to say on this?
The Guardian, unfortunately, doesn't have a huge amount to say. I guess like a lot of the Western press this morning, because this trial has happened behind closed doors, there's very limited information about exactly how the trial was conducted. We do know that Aung San Suu Kyi has been convicted to 5 years in jail on these corruption charges. As you said, this is the first of 11 corruption cases brought against her, which could possibly add up to 190 years in jail if she's found guilty on all of those charges, which I think most observers expect that she will be. The background to this, of course, is that she's been in detention since February of last year, when a military coup toppled her own party's government, which had won the election only a few months before. And even further back, of course, she's been forever in detention. She was under house arrest for the best part of 10 years. So this has been a remarkable political career. But I guess the significance of this trial finding today is that this is probably the end of the road for her. It does look incredibly bad. We're looking at someone now who's likely to spend the rest of her life in jail. And I think this is where this quite remarkable political story probably ends, unfortunately.
And you feel that there is no hope? I mean, could there be international interference to alter this destiny?
It seems very unlikely. There have been a couple of comments this morning by Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International, but their tone is incredibly muted. I think because they can't get access to the courtroom, they can't get access to most of the key players inside Myanmar. There seems to be this real despondency, even in the human rights community, about what can be done here. Also, very muted reaction from most of the foreign embassies in Yangon this morning, because they too haven't been able to get access to the courtroom. They don't know exactly what is going on. And in the face of overwhelming overwhelming power by the junta, the military regime, I think most international actors really seem hamstrung in this case. So this is a really tragic story this morning, and very little seems to be able to be done about it.
Let's go now to South Africa. The New York Times is talking about a new judicial inquiry that's found that corruption at South Africa's tax agency it very much implicates an American consulting firm, but also South Africa's former president, Jacob Zuma.
Indeed. So I guess this continues the corruption theme for this morning. The New York Times has a big piece today looking at what's coming out of the Zondo Commission into state capture in South Africa. And the big finding, I guess, of this New York Times piece today is just how important international management consultancy firms were in the large-scale corruption that happened under Zuma. And they're talking particularly about Bain, the management consultancy company. In essence, what the Zondo Commission has found is that Bain colluded with Zuma in his efforts to take over the taxation commission, the taxation agency in South Africa, and that if it weren't for this collusion with an international consultancy firm, Zuma wouldn't have been able to capture that very important part of the government machinery. The Zondo Commission has found similar findings in relation to McKinsey, the management consultancy company there, and KPMG. So I guess the bigger picture here is that Zuma's corruption and the issue of state capture has been very well known for many years. What was less known was just how important these international economic actors were, that if it weren't for these consultancies coming in and offering their technical advice and their PR advice, and in many ways trying to whitewash exactly what was happening, that level of state corruption really wouldn't have been possible. So I think that this is really important for understanding how this corruption in South Africa was possible, but it also puts a real spotlight on the role of these management consultancy firms, not just in South Africa, but in other parts of the world as well.
Yeah. Now, Zuma, of course, refused to testify before the commission, and that led to his imprisonment for contempt of court. Is he likely to face justice on any of this?
There seems to be real momentum for this. I was just in South Africa last week and talking to some of my friends who are pretty connected in senior ANC circles, and a couple of my lawyer friends. They do think that there's serious momentum for a conviction of Zuma here. The Zondo Commission has gathered this huge amount of evidence over the last few years. It's arguably the world's largest and most extensive investigation into state-level corruption. Much of that evidence now is being made available to the prosecuting authorities. And of course, there's also political will to prosecute Zuma. And I think that's the big point here, is that Ramaphosa really wants to put clear water between himself and the Zuma period. We're building up to South African elections only in about 12 months' time. And so I think the combination of that amount of evidence and that political willpower suggests that Zuma's really in legal trouble here.
But of course, he has such a strong grassroots fan base in KwaZulu-Natal. We've seen all of those people rise up before in his defence.
Indeed. And that's the political fallout that Ramaphosa would have to deal with if these legal cases did go ahead. And we've seen, even in the last 12 months, as you allude to, Ramaphosa show that he's a bit ham-fisted when it comes to dealing with those grassroots organisations. So I suspect that he's going to give the green light to further attempts to prosecute Zuma. But I think there is this concern about what kind of political fallout there might be within the supporter base of the ruling part of the ANC.
Yeah. Now, elections coming up in Northern Ireland, and the FT talks about that it's economic issues that are really rather dominating this.
This is a fascinating set of dynamics, I think, Georgina. It's almost guaranteed, I think most pundits agree, that Sinn Féin will win an historic election victory in Northern Ireland on the 5th of May. Of course, Sinn Féin are a nationalist party, that they've been seeking power in the north of Ireland, as they call it, for decades. It's always been a very distant prospect. Well, it seems that prospect is about to happen. And of course, the basis of Sinn Féin as a political party is fighting for a united Ireland. Now, what's interesting about this election is that polls suggest that there's very little appetite in Northern Ireland at the moment for a united Ireland. That what most people are worried about leading up to the 5th of May is the cost of living crisis, issues of inflation, the quality of the National Health Service in Northern Ireland. So the FT is suggesting, and this is something that I think is resonating in a lot of the British press at the moment, is Sinn Féin may win this election on the 5th of May, but not on the terms that they would have wanted to win it. And this may not necessarily give them a green light to push for a referendum on a united Ireland in the way that I think much of the Sinn Féin leadership would hope it could.
And of course, there's the whole issue of the Northern Ireland protocol? How is this going to play into the election?
And that's the lead up to this election, is that in essence the Northern Irish Assembly doesn't function. It doesn't exist at the moment. The current ruling party, the Democratic Unionist Party, pulled out of the Assembly a couple of months back because of these new Brexit protocols and how they feel that the British government is reneging on its deal and in essence making it incredibly difficult for Northern Ireland to trade with the EU in the way that it would want to. So we've got a National Assembly that basically doesn't function. There's this real sense of political chaos in Northern Ireland. And that's another factor, I think, that would hamstring Sinn Féin if, as expected, they win on the 5th of May, is they're going to inherit this political shambles. So they've been longing for this moment to win power in Northern Ireland, but it seems that they're not going to get the kind of conditions that they might have wished for.
Yeah. Now, we've been reporting all about Twitter, of course, and the fact that Elon Musk has now taken over. He's bought it. Nigel Farage has been whining to Musk. Tell us what he said.
This was a piece in the Evening Standard overnight, Georgina. You can guarantee that the vultures come out of the trees when something big like Musk taking over Twitter happens. And Nigel Farage has delivered in that sense. He's blaming Twitter's algorithm for his plummeting number of followers over the last 18 months or so. He says that the Twitter algorithm amounts to, quote, a form of shadow banning, that Twitter has colluded against him mathematically to lower his coverage. His followers have been plummeting. The number of likes and clicks that he's been getting has been plummeting. He thinks this is another form of cancel culture. And so he has gone whinging to his good friend Elon Musk to say, now that you've got control of Twitter, you have to change the mathematics. You have to change the algorithm to make it more favorable to me. It's not my fault. It's absolutely the algorithm's fault. So please, Elon, do something about this.
And he's not considered for a moment that he might just be completely irrelevant and utterly boring.
Doesn't seem to have crossed Nigel's mind in the slightest. Apparently, it's all in the mathematics. It's not in the man.
All right. Self-awareness, perhaps not one of his strongest.
Surprise, surprise.
Phil Clark, thanks very much indeed for joining us. This is The Globalist on Monocle 24.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage. Built on the unique dedication of our people, we bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work. We know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in to The Bulletin with UBS every week for the latest insights and opinions from UBS all around the world.
Now it's time to talk business with Annabel Williams, who's personal finance specialist at Nutmeg, the UK's largest digital wealth manager. Good morning to you, Annabel.
Morning, Georgina. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. But it's not so great over at Tesla, where the shares have sunk, as we've been reporting in our news bulletin, after Elon Musk's bid to buy Twitter is accepted. Do tell us more.
Yes. So on Monday, it was confirmed that Elon Musk, founder of electric car company Tesla and the world's richest man, will acquire Twitter for $44 billion. It's a company he's an avid user of, but it's not clear how he's going to finance the deal, and he may have to sell some of his stake in Tesla to fund that. As a consequence, Tesla's stock fell 12%, so it wiped $126 billion off its value. And that kind of volatility isn't new to Musk. I mean, he frequently makes remarks, chiefly on Twitter, that affect the company's share price. I'm thinking of a couple of years ago how he stated that he would take Tesla private through a tweet that I think whilst he was smoking marijuana, possibly, which, you know, had a massive impact on Tesla's share price. So Musk himself will probably take this move in Tesla's shares in his stride, but there's a lot more at stake this time. He needs to have enough money to cover the acquisition. He may be wealthy, but he is cash poor, with a lot of his money tied up in ventures like SpaceX, which is going out into outer space and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Now, talking of the social media space, though, very disappointing results for Alphabet, which, of course, is the Facebook, the parent company of Facebook.
Yeah, so it's reported its first quarter results. And although revenues at the group have risen, it made $68 billion in the first quarter. That's a marked deceleration from the same time last year. And this is important because Alphabet makes more money from advertising than any other company. So it's almost a bellwether. And when we talk about its business being affected by advertising, there are other factors too. So it's had to pull out of operations in Russia. And then the kind of unspoken thing that Google or Alphabet didn't really mention in its results was the threat of TikTok. So this kind of fast rising platform that's grabbing the attention of younger users has forced Meta Platforms, which owns Facebook and Instagram, that's had to pour resources into the metaverse in a bid to kind of pull people away from TikTok.
I should just clarify there that Alphabet is in fact the parent company of Google, not of Facebook. One of the things that we're seeing here is of course just relating back to the previous story with Twitter. A lot of people are saying they're going to leave Twitter, but where does that leave them to go? Because as many people have pointed out, well, your mum's on Facebook and your children are on TikTok, and nobody understands Instagram.
Yeah, I mean, and at the same time, Donald Trump wants to, you know, build his own social media platform, which he thinks will be the bastion of free speech. But you've got this huge backlog of users that are unable to even access it. I mean, it's a really interesting question. And yesterday, the kind of economics czar in Europe announced that he would actually prevent Twitter from operating in Europe if it breaches social media rules, and that's Thierry Breton, the UK's the European Union's economic czar. And the thing is that Elon Musk and others see Twitter as this like last bastion of free speech, a place where people can say anything. And you know, Musk thinks that Twitter is constrained. He wants to introduce an edit button so that after people have posted a tweet and it's out there in the ether, they can then go back and redact what they've said. And that has real serious implications for a place where arguably, I mean, all sorts of things are said on Twitter, a lot of them not very pleasant. And yes, it's questionable how much it is already restricted in terms of free speech.
Yeah. And finally, a very quick look at European gas prices. Of course, those have surged because supplies to Poland and Bulgaria are to be shut off today.
That's right. So Russia has demanded that countries pay for fuel in rubles. Poland and Bulgaria have refused, and European gas is up 17%. Now, politically, this is a major escalation in the standoff between Moscow and Europe over energy supplies and the war in Ukraine. But just to dwell a moment on the business implications, you know, chiefly businesses rely on the end consumer, and households across Europe are already grappling with record high prices for filling up their cars with petrol and diesel at the pump, heating and lighting their homes as gas and electricity prices have soared. Inflation is at a 30-year high, and you know, inevitably this is going to have a knock-on effect on spending. So we need to bear in mind that when companies do report their sales figures are up on last year, throughout the rest of 2022, much of that may be the effect of inflation, of companies passing on higher prices when they can, and ultimately consumer spending will be crimped by this surge in energy prices again.
Annabel, thank you very much indeed. And this is The Globalist on Monocle 24. Well, what a week it's been for streamers, especially Netflix, which is expecting to lose customers in the next few months. But what are the reasons for this rocky period? Could it be just bad programming or an overall trend in the industry? Monocle's Paige Reynolds spoke to our senior correspondent Fernando Augusto Pacheco about this and started by asking if password sharing might be Netflix's new enemy.
First of all, it's not a surprise, I think, for many people that, you know, you can share your password. But I think the numbers are quite high. I think there has been articles here in the United Kingdom, I believe around 27% of the Brits do that, and many more in other regions of the world. I mean, Latin America, it's so common, it's almost 50% at times. So I can understand with those bad numbers, because I think Netflix predicts that they might lose millions of customers, I mean, which is quite surprising, because I think they would just wanted to keep expanding on and on, and that that's not really happening. So, of course, there will be a little crackdown, unfortunately, for some. In Latin America, in fact, there are already plans. So, for example, you can pay, you know, $2 extra to share a password with someone else. So they have to rethink their model because it is becoming unsustainable. As you know, they spend a lot of money, but now without the growth, there would certainly be a rethink of their model.
It's interesting. I think some of the Netflix spokespeople who have been kind of interviewed about this issue have said that actually it wasn't really built into their financial modelling before, because let's face it, sharing is something that's just bound to happen. And some of it's very legitimate, sharing with spouses, kids, you know, people that you're in the same household with. Of course, it would be a bit unlikely for them all to have their own separate accounts. But it does seem now that, like you said, because Netflix is not turning the profit that it wants to turn, it's going to have to change its model a little bit. How do you think people are going to respond to that?
It's very hard because people are used to do that, right? And let's talk about cost of living. The whole world is experiencing inflation. And I think a subscription to Netflix perhaps is not priority in someone's lives. So that is certainly a factor, in my opinion. That's the problem. People are used to that. So I think they might lose some customers. But at the same time, because I know they put the prices up, so even though there might be less customers, they might be more profitable. So they have to make kind of a maths game here and there. But I have to tell you, Paige, I don't think it's just the cost of living and their model that is affecting Netflix, in fact.
I'm sure you've got some other opinions about perhaps what other reasons Netflix might be having some issues right now. Anything to do with their programming?
I would say so. And it's very weird because when you say a Netflix film, they have great films, by the way. I'm not saying all of the films are bad, but there's almost kind of a bad connotation. Oh, it's a Netflix film, because it's true. They produce so many things and quite a lot of them are bad, and including TV series as well. So the content, for example, we have the series Anatomy of a Scandal, which I have to be honest, I saw it. I thought it was trashy TV, but the critics hated. And so there is a little bit of an image problem with some of their programming. And let's remember, a lot of people moved to Netflix at the beginning because it was kind of prestige television. You have series like House of Cards and many others that brought kind of some star quality to Netflix. They have that still, but less than what they wanted. Let's talk about films. They really didn't manage to create a franchise that can compete with Hollywood or Marvel. Sure, they have, you know, successful films here and there, but they're lacking a big, a massive hit, I have to say.
It's interesting, isn't it? They've basically just diluted their content. And also, I think the difficult thing about films, and we've spoken about this before, is that idea of premiering something on a streaming service. It just doesn't quite feel the same.
Nobody in the office talks about it the next day because, and I know that that's their style, kind of where they release all the episodes or everything, but then there's a lack of conversation in the office. I remember when Succession was on HBO, everyone in the office like, oh, did you see that? Everybody was kind of watching at the same time. I think that also kind of plays a factor in it as well.
And lastly, Fernando, what kind of streaming services do you think are really worth the money? And do you share your passwords?
Well, first of all, I mean, I got to be honest here. I actually don't share my passwords. I have nothing against. I'm not judging anyone. Especially, actually, I might use someone's Spotify actually account. But no, I don't share it. And that's another reason, Paige. So many new streamers around. And did you see what happened? CNN Plus. It was killed off after a month. So there's a lot of competition out there. I think Disney Plus is doing very well. HBO Max also is doing very well. I think it's coming to the UK in a few years' time. For now, it's Now TV. So there's a competition. I think Apple, the Apple Plus as well. At the beginning, it was a bit lukewarm. I think now they're improving their programming as well. So there's so much out there. And I think we're talking about in this morning's meeting that if you add up all the subscriptions, to be honest, it's more or less what you used to pay for cable. So it's not really much cheaper in a way. So people will make cuts and they will select some of them. I still have my Netflix account. I think, you know, I still think they have some good programming. I'm watching Selling Sunset now. What can I say here? I can't say too many bad things about Netflix.
Okay, well, I'm glad they've still got one streamer in the room.
That was Fernando Augusto Pacheco on Netflix's Troubles. Well, no password required for our archive of stellar content here on Monocle 24. A whole wealth of audio awaits you for free. That's all for today's programme. You can listen back to this or previous episodes online. And thanks to our producers, Paige Reynolds and Sophie Monaghan-Coombs, our researchers, Lillian Fawcett and Samson Mbogo, and our studio manager, Chris Blackwa. After the headlines, there's music on the way and the briefing is live at midday in London. I'm Georgina Godwin, and I'll return on The Globalist at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.